In fact, the new results I'm going to talk about are covered by these three papers here, among which the first one was carried out in collaboration with Helmut Friedrich and Bob Ward. Actually, after the yesterday's lunchtime seminar, I realized that I will give you an example of a completely different type of seminar. Yesterday there was a nice talk about things which exist in our real world, and in the sense that they can be observed without explicitly referring to equations, or almost explicitly without any reference to equations. And now I will give a talk on things which do not really exist in our real world or actual world, but I'm going to use a flood of equations. So the plan of this talk is the following. First, after recalling some simple facts about spacetimes with Killing vector fields, to flash lights on the real motivations of our research, I would like to give a brief review on the rigidity theorem of Moncrief and Eisenberg, which applies for the case of smooth electrowave spacetimes whenever they have a compact Cauchy horizon generated by closed-knot geodesics. In the third part, I would like to show you the basic points of an argument which is expected to give a generalization from the analytic case to the smooth setting of this rigidity result of Moncrief and Eisenberg. And finally, in the last part, I would like to talk about some further generalizations and also some open issues, related open issues, will be addressed. So as it is known by everyone, in any physical theory, those configurations which possess a symmetry are distinguished. Simply they can represent the equilibrium configurations of the underlying dynamical systems. And there is a very nice result from the beginning of 90s by Gerwich and Lindblom, claiming that in any reasonable relativistic theory of relativistic dissipative fluids, the equilibrium states are in fact perfect fluid, are like the perfect fluid configurations, and these configurations possess a four velocity which is parallel to a time-like Killing vector field. It is not really rare to have a theory in which the field equations are simply too complicated to have their general solutions. A nice or easy example is Einstein's theory of gravity, and any of the cases, assuming the presence of a symmetry, considerable simplifications can be achieved. Another immediate example is black hole physics, in which we know that the asymptotic final state of the gravitational collapse of an isolated object is expected to be represented by an asymptotically flat stationary black hole solution. Further considerations lead then to the conclusion, which is referred sometimes to the Hawking black hole rigidity result, that such a black hole spacetime has to be either static or stationary axisymmetric. Another disconnected area where Killing fields play an important role is the validity of linearization theory, in the sense that spacetimes with symmetries can represent critical points of the phase space where the linearization stability fails to be, I mean, the linearized equations, the solutions of the linearized equations will not provide or will not be really connected to a curve of exact solutions of the complete field equations. So they are, in the sense, critical points of the linearization stability problems. There are spacetimes which are of this sort. So all of the above examples indicates that the determination of the precise conditions which can guarantee the existence of a killing battlefield are of obvious physical interest. Now I would like to talk about the case of space-time with a compact Cauchy horizon, which provided a more direct motivation for our research. In fact, a great variety of solutions of Einstein's equations are known which possess a compact Cauchy horizon, but all of these can be considered as certain kind of generalization of the Talmud solution, the two-dimensional space-time diagram of which is shown by this figure. In each of these space-times, the Cauchy horizon separates the globally hyperbolic region from regions which contain closed time-like curves. But a general property of all of these solutions of Einstein's equations that they admit a Killing vector field which is null on the horizon, space-like in the globally hyperbolic region, while the Killing orbits are closed time-like curves in the chronology violating region.
This observation
that
lots of
space-time. Yeah, there are many space-time having this sharing this property. In fact, having a region, a chronology violating region, might be an attractive property because it provides the stage one where one could get rid of the predeterministic style of life one has to suffer from in the globally hyperbolic region. But the whole possibility of having such a chronology violating region is much less tempting if there exists a Killing vector field, a time-like Killing vector field, making this arena to be extremely boring, freezing the dynamics. So it's really an interesting question in what an extent the field equation can guarantee the existence of a Killing vector field in the case of space-time with a compact Cauchy horizon. In fact, such a question is strongly related to the strong cosmic sensor hypothesis of Penrose, which claims that all the physically reasonable generic spacetimes are globally hyperbolic, which implies that no Cauchy horizon can be present, especially no chronology violating region on the other side of the horizon. So in this respect, if one could show that the existence of a compact Cauchy horizon is always associated with the presence of a symmetry, one would have a strong support of the strong cosmic sensor hypothesis of Penrose. And in fact, such an argument, a fundamental argument of this type, was established by Moncrief and Eisenberg, published in two papers in these years. They considered analytic electrowave spacetimes possessing a compact Cauchy horizon, and they assume that the horizon is ruled by closed null geodesics. In this setting, they showed that there must exist a Killing vector field so that the Cauchy horizon is in fact a Killing horizon with respect to this Killing vector field. The precise formulation of result, I need at least certain details of that for the later application. So the precise formulation of the result of Moncrief and Eisenberg is based on the use of Schutterer Gaussian null coordinates, and these kind of coordinates can be introduced by making use of vibration of compact three manifolds with circles. I don't want to give a compact review, but recall some of the basic facts which are important. So what is really important for us, to each closed generator of a compact Cauchy horizon, there exists a small neighborhood, denoted here by N tilde, foliated by other closed generators, so that this neighborhood is diffeomorphic to a Z-third vibration of a solid torus, which can be pictured as follows. So start with a solid cylinder foliated by segments parallel to the axis. Then twist the cylinder by holding one end fixed and rotating the other end with angle 2 pi m over time, m over n, where m and n are co-prime integers. Then all the segments except the central one spirals about. Finally, identify the two ends and this way we get an M-type Z-Fert fibrillation of a solid torus. There are two cases to be distinguished. If the value of N is equal to 1, all the circles close after one circuit of the torus, and this is an ordinary fibration possessing a trivial product bundle structure. The other, in this case it's easy to check that the angle of rotation is just integer times the 2 pi. The other case, when N is not equal to 1, in this case only the central circuit closes after one circuit and all the other fibers and complete circuits. It can be checked, however, easily. I mean, just switching to the M-fold cover of such a torus, that the M-fold cover will possess the property of all the ordinary fibrations. So, without really restricting ourselves, we may assume that we have a foliation, an ordinary foliation of a neighborhood of a closed orbit. And I mean, using a closed fiber, choose a closed fiber from the horizon and choose a neighborhood of that foliated by other closed fibers. We assume that this is an ordinary fibration, and in this case Gaussian null coordinates can be defined globally in a neighborhood of this part of the horizon. Start with coordinates. To do this, start with coordinates u, x3, x4, so that we consider first the solid torus, which is diffeomorphic to our neighborhood n tilde, and u is simply a smooth parametrization of a smooth slicing by these cross sections of the torus. And x3 and x4 are coordinates on one of these cross sections and extended onto the entire the torus by keeping their values to be constant along the generators. Then by making use of the diffeomorphism between this neighborhood and the torus, the solid torus, these three coordinates immediately give rise to be coordinates on the neighborhood of the original closed fiber. And by construction, we will have that d by du is a null vector field on this neighborhood tangential to the generators of larger disk generators of the horizon. The next step in defining these Gaussian null coordinates is consider the unit null vector field L on N tilde, which is orthogonal to these cross sections of N tilde, this neighborhood, and has plus one inner product with the original vector field d by du. By making use of this vector field on N tilde, the force coordinate function can be defined in a neighborhood. N tilde now is represented by this blue line here, and in a neighborhood of N tilde, we can define our force coordinate by making use of the null geodesics, starting on N tilde with tangent L. The R coordinate, I mean, this hypersurface N tilde is assumed to be a smooth null hypersurface, so there exists at least a sufficiently small neighborhood of N tilde so that these null geodesics do not meet within O tilde. And in O tilde, we can define our force coordinate function as the value of the affine parameter of the null geodesic through a point P starting on N tilde with tangent L. Then finally, one can extend these coordinates x, u, x3, x4 from N tilde onto the entire of O tilde, and we get the desired Gaussian null coordinate system. Why is it good to have such a coordinate system? It can be shown that the space-time metric in a Gaussian null coordinate system can be given by the line element written here, where the functions f, aj, and jab are smooth functions of the coordinates capital U, R, X, G, and jab is a positive definite 2 by 2 matrix. All the uppercase latent indices takes the values 3 and 4 you know, the one more more important property which follows from the construction, because we have that entity that possesses a trivial boundless boundless structure, and in turn O tilde possess the same property, and the fibers are closed, immediately we get that all the functions appearing in this line element, and also the components of the Maxwell tensor, are U-periodic. And using then this periodicity property, along with the Einstein Maxwell equations, Moncrief and Eisenberg proved that the function this function appearing in the first term of the line element has to be constant throughout the horizon, and also the R derivatives, this is the offshoring derivatives, derivatives along the geodesics transfers to the horizon, the R derivatives of the functions appearing in the line element and the components of the Maxwell tensor up to any order are U independent on the horizon. Then, referring to the analytic setting, we can conclude, I mean, they concluded that d by du is in fact a Killing vector field, and the electromagnetic field is also invariant.
But d by du was defined in a neighborhood, I think it's.
Yeah?
Begin with d by du was just defined in a neighborhood.
Yeah, d by du is defined only in a neighborhood. I mean, they claim that the Killing vector field exists only in a neighborhood of the horizon, not everywhere. But that's enough for the purpose, you know, just showing that this is a non-generic space-time. I mean,
yeah,
if we have a...
Yeah.
Well, and as we saw, in the analytic case, the existence of a Killing vector field can be shown by the techniques introduced by Moncrief and Eisenberg, and it was an interesting open issue whether this analyticity assumption can be replaced by less restrictive differentiability assumption, and we wanted to show that actually this rigidity theory of Moncrief and Eisenberg generalized to the smooth setting. In switching from the analytic to the smooth geometrical setting, the most important thing we have to face is that suitably detailed information about the space-time metric and the Maxwell field is known only on a single non-hypersurface, N tilde. If we had a Killing vector field, which means that the Killing equation is satisfied, and the integrability condition of the two-form field, written here, would hold, then we could, you know, simply referring to these two equations, determine the vector field by giving only the values of k and nabla k at a single point of the space-time by integrating ordinary differential equations. But the existence of a Killing vector field in fact cannot be shown by this way. As we will see later, the contraction of the integrability condition, however, which is a hyperbolic linear and homogeneous wave equation for the vector field K, it provides a mean to construct a candidate Killing vector field. And this also indicates that our approach is based on an initial value formulation, initial value problem associated with this equation, the last equation here. Because we have a non-hypersurface, it seems to be reasonable to use the non-characteristic initial value formulation, where initial data is specified on a pair of null hypersurfaces which intersect on a space-like two-surface. Again, the main problem is that we have only one single null hypersurface on which detailed information are provided by the theorem of Moncrief and Eisenberg, and to be able to use the non-characteristic initial wave formation, we needed to have another non-hypersurface so that at least the leader of the systematic should vanish on that hypersurface. And we came over on this difficulty by really constructing the second hypersurface generalizing a method which Bob Ward and May used earlier in the case of stationary black hole setting. So we constructed the second null hypersurface and it can be, this construction can be carried out whenever the constant value, this function of the line element f was shown to be constant by Moncrief and Eisenberg on the horizon, whenever this function is non-zero on the horizon, one can we would like to have an initial data hypersurface and we would like to prove the existence of a Killing vector field. The minimal condition which should be expected that the lead derivative of the space-time metric at least has to vanish on this null hypersurface. Of course, by using the machinery of this extendability of space-times, one can show more, but this is needed to be satisfied. Actually, if we start the null hypersurface, this null hypersurface N1, which is just N tilde, there are infinitely many null hypersurfaces transferred to this. But again, the problem is that unless we solve the full Einstein Maxwell equations, we don't know about the behavior of the space-time metric and the electromagnetic field along those null hypersurfaces. So
you're actually in a slightly more general setting than Eisenberg Moncrief. I mean, you don't need any Cauchy rise. You just given some null hypersurface N1.
You can interpret it this way that in a geometrical setting, this is a more general that we had in mind that setting to have our result.
Okay, so in the general setting, what is the function F?
I will show you again the line element. So in the Gaussian non-coordinate systems which were fitted to the setting, F is just R times F is the norm of the Killing vector field, where R measures the distance from the horizon or from the null hypersurface on which the whole Gaussian non-coordinate system is based on.
So R equal to
constant
is N1,
is that right? R equal zero is the horizon.
Yeah.
So R equals zero is the null hypersurface we started with, and possibly, the R equal constant surfaces might be time-like or space-like according to the, the R equal zero surfaces might be. Yeah, here they are time-like and here space-like, but they are not expected to be. What I wanted to say.
R equal to constant surfaces are not necessarily.
But
N tilde is R equal to zero.
Right. Yeah, N tilde is R equal to zero, and off the horizon, these surfaces can have a different kind of characters. I mean, in the case when you have. F and the derivatives of F ever zero, you will have that the neighborhood of this N tilde will be foliated by null hypersurfaces. So the character of these surfaces depends on the actual geometrical setting and physical setting. So what was the claim that whenever the constant value of this function is non-zero, one can construct the needed other null hypersurface for the applicability of our initial value approach. So this goes as follows. unfold the original neighborhood O tilde of the horizon. I mean, here this should correspond to O tilde neighborhood of the horizon, to switching to its universal cover, which possesses the trivial bundle structure R2 cross D, where D denotes the cross section of these cross sections of the original neighborhood. And then, because by doing this, O hat, this neighborhood, inherits the original Gaussian R coordinates of the original neighborhood O tilde, we can, by making use of these coordinates, introduce new coordinates, capital U and V, on a neighborhood of the image of the horizon. I show a figure here. So originally we have this U, R coordinate system. Here is our horizon, and we just switch the universal cover and open up the originally bounded compact neighborhood. We introduce, instead of these U and R coordinates, new coordinates, capital U and V, by making use of these functions, are kappa zero appearing here, related to the this equation, and smooth function G appearing in the definition. V is defined by this relation function F and kappa, so G is a smooth function in a neighborhood of N tilde, and by introducing these coordinates in these new coordinates, the original O hat neighborhood of the horizon can be represented by this coordinate domain bounded by the capital U equals zero surface. So we assume that U runs over all possible values, real numbers, and then for a constant value of kappa, capital U takes values in positive real numbers. So our original neighborhood covered by the R UR coordinates can be represented here, and what is really important for us, it can be shown that the space-time metric and the electromagnetic field, which is defined here, extends mostly onto an enlarged domain of the new coordinates. So U and V are the new coordinates, and we have an enlarged domain of the new coordinates, and the space-time metric and the electromagnetic field extend to this enlarged domain smoothly, and we have this nice setting having a bifurcate type horizon inside in the enlarged coordinate domain. It can also be shown that the vector field d by du, which was defined originally on this part of the new coordinate domain, extends smoothly to a vector field defined on the entire enlarged domain of these coordinates, and the Lie derivative of the space-time metric, here the extended quantities appears, and the Lie derivative of the electromagnetic field vanish everywhere on the bifurcate horizon. So this is a very important property of this extension, space-time extension, that not only providing us a pair of intersecting non-hypersurfaces, but all the relevant quantities will vanish. I mean, the Lie derivative of these quantities vanish on these non-hypersurfaces.
Can you do this for Kalman itself when you get? So you're saying that you can take any space-time with
yeah.
So you can take Talbot.
Yeah.
And you can look at a neighborhood of this Cauchy horizon and extend it in this way.
No, but it, yeah. But we've unwrapped it first.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
You have to. Yeah.
To take.
Okay.
So you unwrap a little, torus sort of neighborhood or closed generator, and then you unwrap that, and then having unwrapped that.
Right, but is the resulting metric something that we've seen before?
You want to know the name of this
Well, I sort of recognize it if I didn't see it.
Well, if you did,
you didn't recognize it. Okay, so it's just some new metric.
The peripheral metric is sort of a funny little bit of a
Yeah, it can be, I think, give the top-knot metric in Gaussian R coordinates originally, then go through this machine range and you will find how the exact form of the metric and the electromagnetic field, metric in that case, will, you know, have this property of having zero leader relative along the generators of the horizon.
So, I mean, this is exactly, you know, a generalized version of the cuspal extension construction in a, you know, completely general setting with the metric of the starting point. So, I mean, people have done, you know, cuspal extensions with tau nut. They're pathological because of the periodicity that you have. You get non-Hausdorff behavior of the patient surface, but we've unwrapped it. So
yeah.
It's just the metric of this cuspal extension, except we're not doing the identification that caused the pathology. It's only being done locally, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Your original horizon was V equals zero.
No, the original horizon here is R equals zero, then here, okay. Capital V equals zero, but okay. Capital U is greater than zero.
Right. What does the capital U equals zero look like in the original coordinates, or is it just not there?
No.
My little U equals
minus.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a very very surprising thing. You know, literally goes to infinity, and the whole thing. I mean, you can imagine. I mean, you can picture the R equals zero hypersurfaces by parallel lines, and the whole thing will open up. By switching to the new coordinates, the U equal minus infinity will open up into a null hypersurface. And this is exactly the other part of the bifurcated horizon, which we...
Okay, so if I did not want to know how to prove it, the result is supposed to be that you give yourself a null surface,
yeah.
There's a killing vector thing on it. On that surface.
Right? Yeah.
So the maximum drive is on that surface. Given that, then you produce an extension of the number of that surface.
In fact, we use the fact that there is a periodicity in a neighborhood of the horizon. I mean, we unfolded the original neighborhood, which means that we somehow provide a kind of U periodicity in a neighborhood, in a complete neighborhood. In an entire neighborhood of the horizon, and by you referring to this u periodicity in the small u coordinate, you can prove the existence of this smooth. I mean, without the periodicity, it might not be.
Right. So, from a general point of view, not the original Heisenberg monolithic thing, but this u periodicity is something that just assumes in addition
in the neighborhood. In the general setting, yeah, one assumes, but it can be proven, for instance, in the black hole setting, that if we have an asymptotically flat stationary black hole, we have a vector field, Killing vector field, which is time-like near infinity and space-like on the horizon, then we have the very same setting having an explicit U periodicity in the small U coordinate in a neighborhood of the horizon.
Can I just say what I'm supposing? I was in general setting, yes. And then we can prove in special cases if this assumption is valid or not. So what would U periodicity? So I got this null surface, and there's a killing vector. Now I want to say there's also U periodicity.
So what's needed to do this extension, I guess, that previous clarification, is not just killing field for some data, but I mean what's being used in this with the Eisenberg-Monkey result, but we can just take this result as a hypothesis that, let's say, in these UR coordinates, not only is the U derivative of all the initial data type things zero, which would be sort of the killing field right on that null hypersurface, so to speak, but if you take all the R derivatives, you know, 54th R derivative off the surface, then the U derivative of that is zero as well.
So you're using that as well.
That is,
yeah, that is needed.
Being used to get a smooth extension. Now we can probably get away with, you know, just C2 and
yeah,
then
yeah.
Then only need three of those derivatives or something like that. But that's being used, and there we're relying on Eisenberg and Nachtfried for this case being used, and Eisenberg and Nachtfried used the U periodicity.
We needed
to look to be such that in the analytic case it would have been a Killing field. I mean, all the derivatives, and then this extension is actually, I mean, an easy way to think of what the extension is that's been done is you take the space-time region that you started with, you take an isometric copy of that and flip it upside down, and then you glue the two parts together, and that's what gives you the extension. Of course, you have to prove that smooth,
yeah.
And so you have to go through all this introduction of Kressel coordinates and all that. But that's
so last something to do with this null killing vector. I mean, null killing vector thing on the surface, and the d by du of
it's killing. It's killing to sort of arbitrarily, well, it's high order. You want smoothness off of the surface, and just first derivatives with no, with respect to u and no r derivatives will not be adequate.
Can you say that again about the flip? I didn't catch that.
Take the two wedges that are in the original space-time that's up in the top right-hand corner.
Right.
Okay, take another copy of that.
Okay.
And
flip that over.
Well, yeah, do a parity in type inversion about the origin. Okay. And then you can glue those two objects together. I mean, you've got to add the U equals zero to a hypersurface boundary, but yeah. You can patch the two together on that boundary so that you go through space-time.
So this is what one does when you go to Kressel from any continuous time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's exactly what this whole thing is.
Okay, so having this space-time extension, one can return to the original problem of initial value problem associated with this equation, which is expected to provide the candidate Killing vector field for us by considering the top edge of the above extended space-time and use as our initial data hypersurface the boundary of the top edge. Solve then this equation with initial data equal the extension of the original d by du vector field onto this enlarged space-time, and what is remains then to prove is that the unique solution of this equation associated with this initial data will be in fact a Killing vector field. So we need to consider some results about the evolution equations for the lead derivative of the space-time metric itself. It can be
I'm confused about normalization.
Yeah?
I mean, supposing you're given a Killing vector field up here, but on the throat it is going to be zero, right?
Yeah.
At the bifurcation.
Mm-hmm.
So and now how do I do normalization up here? Why don't I just is the normalization here? For the smoothness is fixed as a normalization?
That's a fixed question.
Yeah.
If you require the
attention to
this, you have to fix it
down
here, then
it's
fixed.
Yeah, everything is fixed up there. I can multiply by 2, because then it will not be
yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we need to check whether this the unique solution of this equation will be a Killing vector field. And for this reason, one has to consider the evolution equations for the lead derivative. It is known that whenever a vector field K satisfies this equation, but otherwise it's an arbitrary vector field, it can be shown that the lead derivative of this space-time metric with respect to this vector field satisfies this equation, which in the case of vacuum case, where we have the first and the third term to be identically zero, actually will provide, in the vacuum case, linear homogeneous wave equation for the lead derivative of the space-time metric. So we can conclude immediately that the unique solution of this equation with initial data equal with the vector field we derived in the space-time extension procedure be a killing vector field everywhere in the associated Cauchy development. We will see that in case of electroweak setting, a similar result follows, and the argument is not really complicated. By making use of the Einstein's equation for the electroweak case, what is the point here? So we have the evolution equation for the lead derivative of the space-time metric, but here the lead derivative of the four Ricci tensor appears. So we need to take care of this term because these others are also linear and homogeneous in the lead derivative of the space-time metric. So using the Einstein-Maxwell equations, one can calculate, one can determine the lead derivative of the Ricci tensor, which can be given in terms of expressions which are linear and homogeneous in either the lead derivative of the space-time metric or the lead derivative of a four-vector potential associated with the electromagnetic field satisfying the Lorentz gauge condition. By making use of this expression for the lead derivative of the Ricci tensor, one can derive an evolution equation for the lead derivative of the space-time metric, so that on the right-hand side these terms G and A are linear and homogeneous in the lead derivative of the space-time metric and the four-vector potential respectively. Because of the presence of this second term here, to be able to determine the lead derivative of the space-time metric of the horizon or of the initial data hypersurface, we need to take care of the evolution of the four-vector lead derivative of the four-vector potential also, which can be done easily by making use of the lead derivative of the Maxwell equation, which provides us a very similar wave equation for the lead derivative of the four-vector potential, where terms appear again, which are linear and homogeneous in the relevant quantities. So again, this pair of evolution equations are known to possess unique solutions associated with the given initial data, such so they have identically zero solution whenever we have that the lead derivative of the space-time metric and the lead derivative of the four-vector potential vanish on the initial data hypersurface. By making use of this simple result, now we can conclude that the unique solution of our evolution equation for the candidate killing vector field will be in fact a killing vector field everywhere in the associated Cauchy development. And it can be, it follows immediately from the above argument that the electromagnetic field is also invariant with respect to this vector field, and it can be shown that this vector field will be in fact a space-like vector field everywhere inside the top wedge, which corresponds to the globally hyperbolic region of the original space-time we started with. So finally, one has to justify, and it can be done, that this vector field, d by du, will project down, this killing vector field will project down to a well-defined killing vector field on the original elementary neighborhoods, and taking together all the local considerations, or the relevant local considerations, one can conclude that the following theorem, whenever we have a space-time, which is a space-time in the smooth geometrical setting with associated with an electromagnetic field and possess a compact Cauchy horizon generated by closed-knot geodesics, if we assume that the horizon is non-degenerate, which in terms of the functions appearing in the Gaussian algebra means f is non-zero, we have a Killing vector field in a sufficiently small neighborhood of the entire horizon, and the original Cauchy horizon will be a Killing horizon with respect to this Killing vector field, while the Killing vector field will be space-like in the Cauchy development side. It follows also that the electromagnetic field is invariant with respect to this Killing vector field.
So you might
have
another matter field, like,
you know,
scale field or something.
Yeah, I would like to go to that point later. So, in having that result, we can conclude that at least in the case of smooth electric space-time, the presence of a compact Cauchy horizon is, in fact, an artifact of a space-time symmetry. So, by this result, we have a strong support of the validity of the strong cosmic sensor hypothesis of Penrose. There are various cases which are, I mean, having that result, we are still very far from having a complete argument taking care of all the possible space-times with a compact Cauchy horizon. First of all, to be able to use our evolution equations to prove the existence of a Killing vector field in the smooth setting, we needed an initial data hypersurface, which cannot be done and cannot be provided in the degenerate case. Just recalling that when we have f equal a constant, and this constant was denoted by minus 2 kappa 0, this is the quantity which in the black hole case corresponds directly to surface gravity. So whenever we have kappa 0 equals 0, this is the degenerate case, and it can be shown that the vector field k, which is d by du, satisfies the equation for arbitrary values of kappa. KB. So, in the case when kappa is zero, we have that the d by du on the horizon is the tangent field to the generators of the non-geodesic generators of the horizon, and these generators are complete with respect to the u coordinate. So we cannot use the machinery to prove the existence of another null hypersurface transferred to the original one and go to the initial value problem of the relevant equations. Nevertheless, it seems to me that the set of the relevant space-time configurations has to be very limited. For instance, in the vacuum case, one can prove that the space of the larger generators of the horizon, which can be given the structure of a two-manifold, it has to be either a torus or a sphere. In the torus case, as it follows from another result of Moncrief and Eisenberg, the elementary neighborhoods have to be isometric to plane wave solutions, in which case we have a foliation of a neighborhood of the original horizon by null hypersurfaces. While in the other case, we get to the setting of Kerr solution, in which possesses the property that in the extreme case, there exists at least a certain portion of the horizon, so that on both sides of the horizon, the Killing vector field is time-like. Because the Killing orbits are closed, such a horizon cannot correspond to a setting associated with a Cauchy development associated with a Cauchy horizon. So it would mean that at least in a sufficiently small neighborhood of the horizon, we have a chronology violating region.
Just about yeah? Kurt is an example, or is that all the solutions to the sphere?
Well, I'm not sure. These are not fixed. I mean, this result, which I refer to in the case of torus, is valid only for the analytic case. So there are a lot of things which have to be done. And here also, one has to investigate this setting carefully. What I concluded is the following. In the spherical case, there is a vector field. I mean, using the original setting, in our line element associated with the Gaussian R coordinates, we have this function, this form field, and the two metric on the two-dimensional cross section. In the spherical case, the vector field associated with this form field has to vanish, at least assuming that it's smooth, has to vanish at least at one point. And then using this, I have an argument concluding that the first R derivative of this function has to be negative. And in the extreme case, F is equal to zero, the first R derivative is negative, which means that at least at certain region associated with the spherical generator space, there has to be a part of the original non-hypersurface so that on both sides of this horizon, the killing field, which is guaranteed in the analytic setting, will be time-like. And this is not something which is compatible with the Cauchy development picture we had on the better. Yes?
They've been asking about that.
Yeah.
Is it known that extreme curve is the only possibility when you have historical topology? I didn't know there was black hole type uniqueness there.
No. I'm just. yeah.
No, I think it's not clear that you can construct the superpositions of extreme curve.
No, I didn't want to claim that extreme curve is the only possibility.
Right.
Yeah.
But you're arguing that so if we took out extreme, if we took out curve from that sentence, then you're saying
If in the case of curve,
there would be a killing field.
Yeah, the other argument which I wanted to flash here does not refer to the curve space. And I mean, relying on the Einstein vacuum equations and then using some topological argument, concluding that somehow the killing field has to be time-like on both sides of the horizon in a neighborhood of the original non-hypersurface. So this is a partly misleading. So what is more serious here that for the non-vacuum problem there is no argument available for the extreme case. There is a much wider set of spacetimes which the members of which possess a Cauchy horizon, and these are Cauchy horizons generated by non-closed null geodesics. As far as I know, for the analytic electrowave case, there is a rigidity theorem provided by Moncrief and Eisenberg that is similar, I mean, analogous to their previous one, concluding about the existence of a horizon-killing vector field. It's again an interesting problem how one can get rid of the analyticity assumption, which is a expectedly very technical problem, how one can get rid of this analyticity assumption in this general setting. And having all the results about this electrowave problem, one might ask the question, what is about the various other type of matter fields, without really trying to show you the details. I would like to just flash some of the relevant results I have carried out recently. So I considered Klein-Gordon, Higgs, Young-Mills and Young-Mills-Villotton fields in Einstein's theory of gravity, and by making use, detailed use of the relevant field equations and introducing again suitable Gaussian null coordinate system, a result which is completely analogous to the result of Moncrief and Eisenberg can be derived. Namely, again, one can show that for the case of these particular metafields, the function f has to be constant throughout the horizon, and also the r the metric functions, and also the r derivatives of the metafield variables, which are denoted by this tensor field T, and all the space-time and inner space indices are suppressed. So the r derivatives of these quantities are u independent on the horizon up to any order. I would like to emphasize that this result in the analytic setting gives a generalization not only of the rigidity theorem of Moncrief and Eisenberg, but the rigidity theorem of Hawking, which applies for the black hole case, for at least for this particular metafield. The next step, I mean, this was needed to recover the results we relayed on the Einstein-Maxwell case. The next step in switching from the analytic to the smooth case was to provide a space-time extension possessing that bifurcate type horizon structure. So to be able to use again the evolution equations for the candidate Killing vector field, and to prove that that candidate Killing vector field will be in fact a true Killing vector field, we needed to have a suitable initial data surface, and we needed to extend our space-time so that the enlarged space-time possesses a bifurcate horizon. It can be shown that for these particular metafields, referred at the beginning, such an extension can be carried out, and also the leader of the space-time metric and the leader of the vector the metafield variables vanish everywhere on the bifurcate horizon. Of course, in the case of gauge fields, one has to be very careful, and one can refer only certain preferred adapted gauge representations, but there the existence of that kind of representations can be proven. And finally, one has to justify that our candidate Killing vector field d by du is in fact a Killing vector field. And this conclusion, as we saw, was based on the fact that in the electroweak case, the evolution equations for the lead derivative of the relevant quantities were linear and homogeneous wave equations. In fact, this property can be shown to carry over for the above-mentioned particular metafields, and in fact it turned out that this property is shared by a much wider set of possible gravity matter systems. Namely, I considered a covariant metric series of gravity matter systems in which the Ricci tensor can be given as a smooth function of the matter field variables, their covariant derivatives, and the metric. And I assume that the matter field variables satisfy wave equation of this type, where the functions f are again smooth in their indicated variables. In this very general setting, one can prove that the lead derivative of the space-time metric and the lead derivative of the metafield variables will satisfy a very similar set of coupled linear wave equations, which was held for the electroweak case. And in fact, one can prove that if we have a space-time associated with a gravity matter system specified above, and if we consider the domain of dependence of an initial hypersurface of, which is denoted by sigma, in any initial value problem which has the property that the existence and uniqueness of solution of to quasi-linear wave equation is guaranteed in the smooth setting, then one can show that there exists a non-trivial Killing vector field K on the entire of this Cauchy development, so that the matter fields will also be invariant if and only if we have a non-trivial initial data set for the evolution equation, for this equation, so that the initial data sets for the Lie derivative of the space-time metric and for the Lie derivative of the matter field variables vanish identically on the initial data hyperspace. And this result might have some relevance for the possibility of extending the validity of the linearization stability theorem, which has been proven for electrowake and certain Young's settings. So that's all. Thanks a lot for your attention.
So the final formulation, you don't mention null initial data.
Well, in fact, to derive such a theorem, you don't need to refer to any particular initial value formulation. You can have either the standard Cauchy problem, the null characteristic initial value formulation based on two intersecting null hypersurfaces or on a null cone. What is needed is really the existence and uniqueness of solutions to quasi-linear wave equations. What is the basic essence of the result and
the
conclusion?
The scientific way of looking for killing vectors would be to evaluate all the number of invariants and then check if they are independent functions. Take certain four invariants, which in generic case are independent curvature, take the derivative, and take wedge product and see if it's zero or not. If it's zero, mm-hmm. then you have some candidate with killing vector because they have common directions here, annihilate. And then we go on, and then we have the higher invariants and so on. So does this method work in practice? Or
no, I mean.
The methods which people who for instance, write algorithms to tell between two different geometries and two different manifolds, it's hard to tell if they're different or intermorphic. Then it's a bit what they do. They evaluate invariants and then make a mesh from those invariants.
Well, I'm afraid I have to tell you that, you know, this method has to be called not being a scientific type of method or approach. I mean, yes. At the moment, I cannot say anything about the invariants you are talking about, but, you know.
I think you probably
you just differentiate Riemannian curvature.
Yeah, you are welcome. I mean, if you can make use of this result and then tell me or tell other people about the possibility of, you know, what are the properties of the invariants, then it's fine. I mean,
that's certainly not a foolproof method because there are space times, you know, with non-zero curvature for which all the curvature invariants are zero. So you'd never be able to find the field that way.
Yes, but that doesn't differentiate curvature.
But all of those
invariants. Just the
all the invariants are zero in the plane way space time. So because everything's null and then.
But
you think they're only
plane
waves? Well, I'm saying if you were given one,
but it's still more generic.
If you just, I mean, like this question about general settings and you presented it from the point of view of the cosmic transition.
Yeah.
So, the previous transparency, you had this thing about the topologies, or one of the biggest transparencies, that the topology is either a true sphere or a torus.
Yeah.
What is the most general setting I can make in an abstract setting without referring to quotient margins or anything like that? I've just given this is setting.
Yeah, in this quality. Non this degenerate
but in general, is it all? I mean, can I make statements about topology in general or only in the degenerate case?
No, only in the degenerate case you can conclude some result. I mean, one can derive the equations in the degenerate case, which says something about we have a two-dimensional space of larger degenerators, and we have the geometry on that which is, you know, independent of the parameterization of the generator. So we have a covariant derivative associated with that, and it can be shown that this divergence of the form field age can be related somehow to the curvature plus or minus the norm of this form field, which is derived by making use of this metric, which is equal to zero, and then using the positive definiteness of the metric, and you know, we have a compact two manifold with a boundary, we can say something about the Euler characteristic of the space of generators, and then you have this have to be either zero or two, and then.
But you already use x equals zero.
Yeah, yeah. To derive this equation, you have to use it. Yeah.
The second thing was about the constancy of kappa of f in general.
This constant of kappa follows from the field equations, but in there is an attempt in one of the papers I showed on the first transference, in which I tried to use as general matter field setting as it was possible. So I assumed then that the dominant energy condition is satisfied by matter, and use this setting of the compact Cauchy horizons and the setting for the Black-Hough rigidity theorem. And it turned out that by making use only of the dominant energy condition, one can prove that kappa is, one can introduce a suitable Gaussian R-coordinate system so that f is constant throughout the horizon, and also one can prove the u-independentness of these quantities on the horizon. And then by making use only this very limited knowledge about the geometry, one can prove that there exists an extension of the space-time. Again, having the bifurcate horizon structure, but we have only C0 geometry on this particular boundary where we patch together the two copies of the original space-time region we started with. So the geometry is smooth everywhere except this non-hypersurface, which gives a kind of confirmation of our former claim with Bob Ward that, for instance, the black hole horizon of a stationary black hole has to be either bifurcate or the horizon is degenerate. I mean, in that case, we cannot do this kind of things. But you know, if you let into the play the more details of the fields, the matter fields, which you put into the setting, then you can prove higher order extendability of this picture.
This last point on your transparency up there, this is what Jim and I are trying to get written up, but it might be worth mentioning that if you go to the next most interesting case after the closed generators that you have talked about, the generators turn out to be densely filling of two tori that in turn fill up the three surface, the three manifold. But then the conclusion is that the space times are actually smaller, and you know, family, the collusion is actually smaller still because it has an extra filling. I mean, it's larger in one sense because it's non-closed generators, but smaller in the sense of having an extra filling field. So, in some sense, the case you've described is probably the most, you know, the largest family of solutions.
Oh, I forgot to mention that this result hasn't been published, so I'm not really familiar with it.